Some housing news today, a little bit of economic mobility, some energy policy as well, and pancakes from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 21st of December. Good to have you along, everybody. There is going to be an interesting dance going on in real estate in the new year with interest rate increases and thus mortgage rate increases a-coming. It's going to take a while for that to play out, of course, but as we wait some news today of home sales, the National Association of Realtors reported this morning that sales of previously owned homes bumped up last month to their highest level since early 2007. Before the you-know-what. Marketplace's Andy Baxter gets us going with the state of play in American real estate.
Nicole Stern and her husband have been trying to sell their house in St. Paul, Minnesota for a few months, which is hard in winter. But they decided to go ahead anyway and buy their next home.
We were able to lock in a really low interest rate for the mortgage. So that was definitely a motivation for us putting an offer in even before our St. Paul house sold.
They closed on the new house in October when rates were ticking up, but before a steeper post-election spike. But there were a lot of other factors in their decision besides mortgage rates, like getting a great deal on the new house. Krishna Rao is an economist at Zillow.
Rates are increasing, but they haven't quite increased enough to really change a major decision like buying a home.
Rao doesn't think there's enough inflationary pressure in the economy to make mortgage rates skyrocket. And he says it's important to weigh other factors in a home purchase, like having a solid down payment. That's how Lauren McAvecky and her husband are thinking about things. They're prioritizing saving enough cash to put 20% down on a place in Phoenix, even if mortgage rates tick up in the meantime.
When we talk about buying, it hasn't been, oh, we better get in there, you know, within the next 6 months.
There are other reasons home sales may not continue surging. A fair number of potential first-time buyers are still parked at their parents' houses. Here's economist Kristen Reynolds at IHS Global Insight.
People aren't creating new households, and so there are fewer people to be purchasing homes.
Add to that a shortage of properties available, and Reynolds expects home sales to moderate in 2017. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
It pains me as an audio professional to say this, but it is really hard to get audio to go viral, to catch on and become part of the zeitgeist. Enter then Facebook. The company is going to roll out a live audio feature over the next couple of weeks and months, just a year or so after its big live video push. We got our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood on the phone to make me smart on this one. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So what do you think? Is Facebook the company that can finally make audio like a viral thing?
I mean, audio has definitely had a comeback, so yeah. It's sort of validating for, you know, some of us in the audio business to see that Facebook wants to get in here. I don't know that the goal is necessarily to make it viral. I think it's more to make it easily accessible and to make Facebook a bigger destination for people who are looking for essentially what becomes always-on entertainment.
And does it become then yet another revenue driver, right? More people equals more money, and that's the deal.
Live streaming of anything, whether it's video or audio, has been a bit of a tough sell for a lot of traditional publishers because there just isn't the scale. Like, you can't assume that enough people will be watching all at the same time. So I think Facebook is hoping a couple things. One, that there are enough people there to click ads, and also that it will become a thing that makes you never want to leave Facebook because whenever you're there, either a friend is live, a TV show that you like or some sort of video publisher that you like is live, or there's an audio program that you want to listen to.
All right. So the BBC is going to be on there apparently at the start. HarperCollins doing book stuff, I guess, and some authors. I imagine that if you're like a podcaster or something, you want to get in on this?
I think podcasters are really excited about this and hopefully not disproportionately so,
yeah.
Because it has the potential to be a really easy platform for live audio streaming, and that's something that people are really into. The question really is how easy Facebook's going to make it. We don't know what the revenue share is going to look like, how ads are going to work, and we don't know how it is going to roll out to people. What is it going to let you, if you're two people in two different places? This is something we have struggled with in terms of Facebook Live video. Right now, I think the safest assumption is that these tools are meant for publishers, for big name publishers who are looking for additional outlets, and that Facebook can piggyback on their prestige.
As we sit here talking about this, it occurs to me that some overwhelming percentage of Facebook videos are viewed with the sound off. right? And right? So put two and two together for me here and make sense of audio now in this environment.
That is an outstanding point. And I think, you know, a lot of people are surfing Facebook at work, and there's been a whole genre of video developed around the sort of idea of video that you read. Audio is a little more risky for all the reasons that it isn't viral, right? You have to be engaged in it. It's likely to be consumed more on mobile. So then you pull up Facebook and you start up an audio stream and you're listening to an audiobook or a podcast while you're surfing Facebook. But you're right. It's probably less useful for people sitting at the computer at work.
Would you say that live video has been a success for Facebook?
I don't know, because Facebook's kept it very close to the vest. I will say that historically, live is so tempting for publishers. Everybody wants to do it, all the way from, you know, live breaking news to Twitter to something like Axis TV, which does live concerts. It is hard to get audience numbers big enough to justify the cost.
Right. Molly Wood, she's our senior tech correspondent. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure, Guy.
Wall Street Today, ixnay on the ow day enti tway ausend thay. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Charlotte, North Carolina has been in the news this week as state lawmakers debate the repeal of HB 2, the bathroom bill there. Charlotte is North Carolina's economic powerhouse. It's a huge banking center. And yet the city is near the bottom in rankings of economic mobility. If you are born poor in Charlotte, you are likely to stay poor. So Marketplace's Rima Crace looks at how that city is grappling with its reality and what it's doing to close the mobility gap.
Eastway Drive winds through Charlotte for miles. At one end, the road is dotted with modest apartments, laundromats, payday lenders.
Small retail mall complexes.
Brenda Tyndall is a historian with the Levine Museum of the New South. She says the eastern part of the city is mixed income, but with pockets of deep poverty. The Greer Heights neighborhood, for example, has a median income of less than $17,000. But just a few blocks away, the scene shifts dramatically. We enter South Park.
Beautiful, beautiful homes.
With white columns, porches, super green lawns.
Many of the streets are named after Ivy League colleges and universities.
The median income in South Park is around $90,000.
Segregation is very much a part of how our city is laid out. Literally a block away was Section 8 housing.
And the people who live in public housing will likely never make it here. In Charlotte, the chances of a child born into poverty moving into, say, a 3,000-square-foot home on Princeton Avenue are, well, near impossible. Nathaniel Hendren teaches economics at Harvard. He's part of a team of researchers that's done extensive work on mobility in America.
For low-income kids, Charlotte is one of the worst places to grow up in the United States.
In fact, he says a child raised in poverty has just a 4% chance of rising to the top.
But if instead you had grown up in, say, Sacramento or Minneapolis or other areas, we see rates of upward mobility that are more than twice as high as that.
His findings have surprised and horrified a lot of people here. It's easy to see Charlotte as a land of opportunity. It's the biggest city in North Carolina and a magnet for young professionals. Behind New York, it's the second largest banking center. Bank of America is here. So is Wells Fargo. But change your vantage point and...
Charlotte is looked at as a cautionary tale.
Justin Perry is a father and community activist. He says in the 70s, Charlotte appeared to be headed in a promising direction.
A unanimous Supreme Court today affirmed the principle of busing school children to desegregate schools.
For years, Charlotte was known as the city that made desegregation work. Research shows that integrating the city's schools helped narrow the achievement gap between Black and white students. But in the early 2000s, a court order ended busing, and students returned to neighborhood schools. Today, a quarter of Charlotte schools have state exam pass rates that are below 50%. And nearly all of those schools are predominantly African American and Latino.
I feel like we've compromised ourselves and lost our way, but the beauty of it is that, you know, no mistake is ever permanent.
Perry is part of a grassroots group that advocates for more diverse neighborhoods and schools. The city's also launched a 20-person opportunity task force to address broader inequities. Then there are private efforts. This year, the local Goodwill created a $22 million campus to train and place people in jobs.
So this class is all about self-assessment. You might take some tests and think, wow, I did better than I thought I was going
to
do.
Maybe about 15 students are here in Philip Gaber's class to learn how to dress for a job or use Excel. 48-year-old Kimberly Carr, who sits at the very front, describes what interviews are like for her.
You have to basically sell yourself. Exactly. You know what I'm saying? And you may have to go beyond what you really are. I'm really a shy person. So, like, coming to this class, I have to talk.
Carr was raised by a single mom on the outskirts of the city. Since high school, she's worked a series of low-wage jobs as a nursing assistant and customer service rep. But a couple of years ago, things started unraveling. First, her computer, which she used for work, gave out. Then her 27-year-old Buick Regal. Didn't take long before she was in a homeless shelter.
You're laying in a bunk in a room full of 300 other people, and you're trying to sleep so you can figure out what to do the next day. That's the lowest moment.
Carr's back on her feet now, and she's here at the Goodwill campus to train for her next step.
You know, I wouldn't mind being a medical unit secretary.
Medical secretaries start out making about $14 an hour, but they get benefits and a chance to move up. In Charlotte, North Carolina, I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
President Obama's been working on his environmental legacy his last couple of months in office. Most recently, the ban yesterday on offshore drilling in ecologically sensitive parts of the Arctic and the Atlantic Ocean. The oil and gas industry and its supporters say the move comes at a cost to affordable energy and energy independence, which means it's time for Marketplace's Scott Tong to have a look at that idea, energy independence in an ultra-global market.
Even if the U.S. cut imports to zero, we'd still pay sky-high prices if the rest of the world did. We all pay a global price. Oil-rich Norway paid through the nose when Hurricane Katrina took out U.S. refineries. Drivers in energy-rich Britain did too when crude prices spiked in 2008. Retired General James Conway is with the group Securing America's Future Energy.
It's like an apple in a bucket. As prices go up in one place, they must necessarily go up someplace else. If supplies go down in one country, they go up someplace else. And we're involved in all of that.
And even if the U.S. stops importing oil, other countries would step in to buy from petrostates. Plus, there's a downside if the U.S. cut itself off from the world and stop exporting its oil products, says Edward Chow of the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The United States is now the largest petroleum product exporter in the world because we have domestic production. We also have some of the most efficient refineries anywhere in the world. That export have benefited our trade balance.
To some, the real solution is not pumping out more oil, but making it a less critical thing in our lives. Once upon a time, the crucial commodity was salt, says Ann Corin of the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security.
Now, nobody cares whether we import any salt, what world salt price is, who controls the world salt reserves, because there came about competing means of food preservation.
Having alternatives reduced dependency. Until and unless those come along, we're all in this global oil market together. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
These are tough days to be a packaged food company like, say, General Mills, which reported disappointing earnings yesterday, or ConAgra, maker of Chef Boyardee, and Ready Whip, it reports tomorrow. American shoppers are increasingly skeptical of processed foods, and that means once iconic products aren't selling as well as they used to, while at the same time, Wall Street keeps pressing those companies for higher profits and cost-cutting, which makes it harder to invest in developing new products. Marketplace Mark Garrison reports now from New York.
If you want to get a handle on just how much American taste is changing, look at your grocery store like a cartographer. The action is increasingly not in the middle where all the cans and boxes of processed food sit, but in the produce and meat sections on the edge. Aaron Lash follows the packaged food industry for Morningstar.
Consumers have been shopping the perimeter of the grocery store in search of fresh, healthy fare.
General Mills admitted this week that part of why sales were disappointing was the company didn't spend enough on creating and marketing new products that'll draw shoppers in. The company does say it has high hopes for a new Very Berry variety of Cheerios without artificial colors and flavors. David Hankis isn't sure that kind of thing alone is enough for the industry. He's with Technomic, a food consultancy that has worked with various packaged food companies, including General Mills.
Adding new flavors or taking things out might have success for a quarter, two quarters, three quarters, but it's not necessarily true innovation that's driving long-term growth.
This is where the tension between short-term and long-term performance gets tricky. When sales fall, investors push for short-term cost-cutting. But that can be dangerous, explains Dartmouth business professor Kasum Ilawadi.
Unfortunately, that's when companies cut what they consider discretionary, which is R&D and advertising, and that's exactly the wrong thing to do.
If struggling companies cut back on investing for the future because of troubles in the present, they risk not having as bright a future to look forward to. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we all know that talk about food has exploded, but they don't cook it as much as I'd like to see them do.
Mark Bittman talks about modern food culture and pancakes. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow off 32 points today, about a 10%, 19,941. The NASDAQ down 12 points, a quarter percent, 5471. The S&P 500 gave up 5 points, about a quarter percent, 22.65. On this first official day of winter, rising gas prices sent gas-producing companies higher. Southwestern Energy spiced up 5.75%. Valero Energy up about a half percent. Health stocks swooned, though. Insurer Anthem fell 1.8%. Aetna blew down 1% today. FedEx down 3.33%. It reported worse than expected second quarter earnings yesterday. Sportswear maker Nike rang up 1% today. Twitter click down 4.75%. Its chief technology officer said yesterday he's going to become the latest executive to quit the company, made the announcement in a tweet. Of course, you're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Streaming is the way most of us get our music, but no one company has figured out how to make that work yet monetarily for the people actually making the music. Ethan Diamond is giving it his best shot, though. He's the CEO of the music publishing platform Bandcamp, digital and physical sales combined. And his inspiration to start the company, he said, came after he bought an album online but didn't get his music.
I wrote to the address on the website, and the lead singer ended up writing me back and sending me a direct link to the record, which, you know, I could have then shared anywhere on the internet. Of course, I didn't. But, you know, from a tech perspective, it was a complete train wreck, and this just killed me because, you know, this band had clearly spent a lot of time, put in a lot of effort, and spent also a lot of money, and they ended up with something that didn't really work.
The lay of the digital music landscape in 2007, when you started Bandcamp, was a completely different beast than it is today. Give me the thumbnail sketch.
Sure. So at the time, 2007, you had sites like MySpace and Verb and iMeme. And what they offered artists was essentially a sharecropping arrangement. You know, you gave them your content, and then it was their logo, it was their advertising, it was their URL, it was their traffic, it was their entire identity. And it seemed crazy to me that, you know, if you were a writer at the time, you had things like WordPress, movable type, Blogger, all these things that let you create a site for free and very easily. But if your artistic output was music instead of words, you were completely out of luck. So we built Bandcamp to address that problem.
Break down the business model for me. Let's say I go on Bandcamp and I pay $1 for a song. I'm making up this number. How much does the artist get? How much do you get? And lay that out for me.
Bandcamp's model is based on a revenue share. It's 15% on digital, 10% on physical. And in that way, our success is tied to the success of the artist. So we only make money if the artist makes a whole lot more money.
Which is all great, but if I can get all the music I want, on Spotify for $10 a month, why am I not going to do that as opposed to Bandcamp?
Sure. So none of those services really address music fandom. When I like a piece of music, I like to not only listen to it a bunch of times, but I also like to maybe get the LP and pour over the liner notes and buy their T-shirts, go to their shows, maybe put their poster on my wall. And it's that sort of engaged fandom that that Bandcamp is here to offer.
So here comes a loaded question. It must make you, and I'm going to guess you've talked to artists about this, and it certainly makes them crazy, when, you know, just for instance, Spotify pays, what is it, like 6/1000ths of a cent for each stream or something?
Yeah, that's right. You know, the technology of streaming is great. You find music that you like, you press play, and you're instantly listening to your music. Mm. But the word streaming, especially in the music business, is frequently used to describe one particular business model, and that's the model of unlimited subscription-based music rental. Mm-hmm. And as a business, you know, that that model is still unproven, even after hundreds of millions of investment dollars raised and spent.
You know, it feels like we have been talking about digital distribution of music and how artists can make money from it, and at the same time, consumers can have choice since, like, back in the days of Napster, you know. Where are we going to go?
Well, I think that what we're going to end up with is a place where there are going to be a handful of big technology companies for whom music is an entry point into their ecosystems. So companies that make most of their profit from things like hardware, cell phone service plans, maybe other subscription services, they use music as a way to get people into those systems. For our part, you know, we see music in a very different way. It's not a commodity. It's not content to get you into something else. It's art. It's art that people pour their souls into. So we're here to serve those artists and the fans who see music in that same way.
Ethan Diamond, he's the CEO of Bandcamp. Ethan, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
If you're into food and cooking, you know the work, surely, of Mark Bittman. He's been a columnist for The New York Times. He's done TV shows. He's written a bunch of books, including, most recently, How to Bake Everything.
I started writing about food in 1980. I'd been cooking for about 10 years at that point, and I'd been freelance writing for about that long also. I was a complete failure as a freelance writer. And then I started writing about food for whatever reasons. I was successful pretty quickly. So I could go on, of course. We all know that talk about food has exploded, but they don't cook it as much as I'd like to see them do. We really had, you know, I don't know if national tragedy is too strong or not, but it's a really sad thing that a generation or two of people did not have much exposure to cooking in their own homes. And there are a dozen reasons that happened. It's a boon. It's a wonderful thing that people are recovering from that and that increasingly young people, especially young parents, are wanting to cook and wanting to raise their children, understanding that the best food is food cooked at home. I would say of all the recipes I've ever done, the one that has gotten me the most personal thank yous has been the pancake recipe, which is just hilarious because there's nothing easier than pancakes. This is the easiest thing in the world to remember. For two people, you take one cup of flour, one teaspoon of baking powder, and one teaspoon of sugar and a dash of salt. So that's all ones if you count the dash of salt as a one. And you stir those things together. And then in another vessel, a cup or a glass or whatever, you beat together one cup of milk and one egg. So those are ones also. And then you combine them. That's pretty much it. Then you turn those into pancakes. I cook them in butter. I warm some maple syrup. And I make them you know, as delicious as I possibly can.
Makes you hungry, right? If you missed that pancakes recipe, we've got it online, of course, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a couple of items actually via Trump Tower. There is going to be in President Trump's White House a new policy shop. It's going to be called the National Trade Council, on a par with the National Economic Council. Trump advisor Peter Navarro is going to run it with a focus on industrial policy, the transition team says. Navarro, it's worth a mention here, is a severe critic of our trading relationship with China. Also, Carl Icahn, the billionaire activist investor, is going to be a special advisor to the president on overhauling federal regulations. He is also, according to the Wall Street Journal, advising on selection of the new head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, too. All right, we're out of here. The Dow off 32 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ down 12 points, about a 0.25%. The S&P 500 gave back 5 points, 0.25% there as well. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.